Let me start out with some announcements for next week. Because we did not have lab today, it's going to mean that, yes, we are not able to do the last experiment, and I do apologize for those of you who had done the pre-lab, and then maybe you could say expended some wasted time. Because we only have Monday, then, to review for the lab quiz, the only fair thing I could think of is that this is going to be my first ever, is it? If not, then the second, since I've been here, open note lab quiz. So I do strongly recommend that you read over the separation schemes for part A, B, and C for the cations, because we'll discuss that on Monday as part of our review. We'll go into a little bit more detail as I had been wanting to do, but because you don't have any more time than that to study, because you should have had an additional weekend to study, then to make it a bit more fair, I'm going to make it open note, and I'm not going to make it impossible. Because I know that often happens when you have open note exams. Yes.
So, this lab exam isn't cumulative.
It is not cumulative. The lab exam is only for what has happened since the previous lab exam, with the exception that I would possibly cover the group A cations again. But no, it is not cumulative.
Oh, so group A is going to be on there.
Group A is going to be on there along with group B and group C. Yes. No. Yes. The lab report, so the cumulative lab report for the qualitative lab is going to be due the day of finals. And I just realized yesterday, did I for section two tell you what the format is going to be for that lab report? Okay, heavily simplified from what I had originally envisioned, which is that all you have to do is list the group A, group B, and group C cations, list a one sentence or very brief description of what you saw for the behavior of the known samples as you did the tests, and then say what kind of behavior you observed from your unknown sample, and then say whether you think you have that cation or not. I will, after the exam, release the identities of the unknowns so that you can know that, yes, you did get it correct or not. Yes?
Will the report be graded on accuracy?
No, it will not be graded on whether you got the correct results, just whether you well enough described your observations. Now, when I say well enough, that doesn't mean give me paragraph after paragraph. I really do want the short summation. So, for example, if you were supposed to see a yellow precipitate and you observed a yellow precipitate, that's all you need to indicate. Partly, this is for my own benefit, because since the last time I did this whole sequence was 7 years ago, I don't have my own notes from what students tend to get when they go through this scheme. So that's why I want to save some of the best of these that I collect for the use the next time I teach 1C. Yes? Sure.
So we don't have to write an intro or
Nope. Very simplistic, because I also don't want to overload you at the end of the quarter unfairly. Since what you're going to learn from it in terms of time and content, I don't think the balance is right to have a huge report right here at the end of the quarter. Yes. No, go ahead.
Okay, so we don't have the electrochemistry report?
The electrochemistry report is also going to be due the day of the final. I will go over the calculations on Monday. So that'll give you a week and change to work on it. It won't be a terribly long lab report, but it'll be one that is more the traditional format, where you have the purpose, the data, calculations, conclusion, discussion, like we did the previous report. Now, for the fourth exam, I think that the best thing to do is to have that on Friday of next week. That gives me the most time to cover the material, most time for you to study. I'm not sure when we will do the review for the final, but sometime next week we will do a comprehensive review for the final. If it ends up being in lab on Monday, then maybe that's where it'll be. So at least you can start studying for the final. So the two reports that you're going to have to turn in still, the electrochemistry report and the qualitative analysis, that's going to be due the day of the final. The lab exam is still fixed for Wednesday of next week. I hope all of you have heard already that the following Monday, when we were supposed to have class, that's canceled, as well as class this Friday is going to be canceled, and that's due to the interviews that we're going to be doing. Then the lecture exam is on Friday of next week, and I think that tackles everything in terms of things due and exams and such. So any questions? Sure, you can email the lab reports, and if you wanted to get the qualitative lab in early because you just wanted to get it out of the way, there's not a problem with that. Yes? No, so that's why I'm saying that it's going to be due the day of the final because you don't have any guidance yet how to do the electrochem lab. And I'd rather give you some direction so you don't do extra work or you make sure that you do what I'm asking at the same time, too. Any other questions or clarifications? Then let's get into the content. I know that Monday we did a brief run-through of pretty much the entire chapter 23, on transition metals and transition metal complexes. I want to work backwards today because what, in my mind, might be one of the more interesting or logical topics might be one of the toughest for you all, just because one of my pet interests, you could say, is atomic and molecular orbital theory, but it's not most other people's. So I want to talk about octahedral splitting, which how many of you read the chapter? Oh, because how many of you are barely surviving in all of your other classes as well? Yeah, okay. I was a student once. I know. But please, you've got... this is the last day you're having class this week. You've got Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday to at least pretend, you know, just wave the book in front of you a little bit. Look at the pretty pictures at least, right? Because there is some interesting stuff in here, particularly like those of you who might be on the biological track. There is a side note at the end of the chapter that talks about the change in color of blood as it is oxygenated versus deoxygenated. It has to do with a transition metal complex. And so I want to talk a bit about that color change today, which that color change is related to a change in energy of the d orbitals that happens when we put these ligands around a transition metal. So the book does mention three different types of bonding models. And the reason that there are these different bonding models is that you start from different sorts of assumptions. So I know that we've had this kind of crash course review in atomic theory, and I'm not going to cover that today, except I want to bring up one small point. If you think about the shapes of the atomic orbitals, an S orbital versus a P orbital versus a D orbital, and if you look at the nodes, in general, all of those nodes pass exactly through the nucleus for those spherical nodes. I mean, or the shapes are spherical in nature. So an S orbital itself is a sphere. A P orbital has a node right through the middle of that orbital. D orbitals, four of them at least, have nodes that pass straight through the middle like that. So in other words, the shapes of atomic orbitals are governed by the fact that you have that one nucleus in the center, and then you have the electrons doing whatever they're doing around it. What happens when you have a molecule? One example of that, which is going to be harder and harder for me to give because soon nobody's going to remember the old school TVs, the big glass tube TVs that weighed a ton, right? How many of you still have those? Yeah, exactly. So used to be I could give this example that if you took one of these old school TVs and if you were a bad kid like I was at times, so you put a magnet up against the TV because I just wanted to see what happened, right? What would happen? Anybody happen to know? Well, you can temporarily screw up your TV, yes, but what you'll see is all these different color patterns that all seem to rotate around that spot. So the reason there are color patterns generated is that the electron beams that are shooting at that tube can be deflected by a magnetic field. You put that magnetic field up there and you get that deflection. But what patterns you get generated depends on the fact that you've got that one magnet on the screen. If you take another magnet and put it up there, then it's going to change the patterns that you get. And it'll look like the two spots where the magnets are somehow connected by these color patterns. It's kind of a stretch, but imagine that the same thing happens with molecules. That if you have one nucleus, you're going to have all these electrons acting like waves around that nucleus. But those patterns that those waves generate are, in terms of geometry, governed by the fact you only have that one nucleus. Well, what if you suddenly have two nuclei? Then those patterns are going to change. So how can we describe bonding using atomic orbitals if, in some sense, those atomic orbitals don't exist in a molecule? That's the point I'm trying to make. There's all this nasty, complicated math, which we didn't even really see any of, that's behind atomic orbitals. So you go through all that work and finally understand what an atomic orbital is, and then you have to throw it away because, in a sense, it doesn't exist in a molecule. So that's where these different bonding models come from, because some of the models try to look at the molecular orbital aspect, and that's valence bond theory. Some of the models try to imagine that some of the effects that we're going to see in these transition metal complexes are due to charges, and it treats these charges as points, like particles. But we know that in real life, electrons act like waves. So if you assume that you have these particles, well, maybe it will predict some aspects of this system that we end up with, but it might fail to describe others. And that's exactly what the book happens to mention. So for the level of this course, given where we are in the quarter, I'm not going to hold you all responsible for describing the differences between these different bonding models. I'm just trying to say that what I'm going to present is a little bit of atomic orbital theory, because we got to talk about d orbitals, and then we're going to talk about how those d orbitals are changed, imagining that we have these charges that are around it. That does partly ignore the wave nature of the electrons, but that's the model that we're going to use here. It's the crystal field theory model, and it's a simple enough one to explain as long as you can deal with the shapes of d orbitals. Let's start with the shapes of those d orbitals. There are five of them. For any d orbital, what is the value of L?
2.
What does that mean? So there are four quantum numbers. N, which is what? The principal quantum number, correct? And what does that tell us? How much energy that we have in the electron, the total amount of energy. And one of the zillion points I was making in the review of atomic orbital theory is that once you know the total amount of energy, then you get to choose, you could say, how that energy gets distributed. So L tells you what? The number of nodes in what way, what kind of geometry are those nodes in? What spherical? In other words, they're cutting the atom as if it was an apple, just chopping through that atom. And once you make those certain number of nodes, that gives you the shape of the orbital. So L being 0 gives you an S orbital, something that looks like a sphere. L being 1, you get the dumbbell shape, where half of it's shaded one way, half of it's shaded the other. For L equals 2, that's the d orbital. That's how you end up with these different shapes. There is the dxy orbital, where the lobes, L-O-B-E, that's like the petals, you could say, of this flower, lie in the xy plane. Notice that they don't lie on the axes, they lie in between the axes. I'm going to shade this orbital, which, if because of time, we don't end up coming back to do my little crash review of molecular orbital theory. These shading patterns matter for when, if you cover it, for when you talk about bonding. Because as I was saying earlier, you can't really describe molecules just with atomic orbitals. You've got to make a little bit of adjustment. So we can use those atomic orbitals to model bonds, and knowing the shading pattern is critical for that discussion. For us, I just want you to know what the shapes of the d orbitals are. Now, there are three other orbitals that look pretty much just like this. There's the dxz and the dyz. And those have their electron density on the XZ plane. And in the YZ plane, respectively. Am I going to make you draw these things out? I don't know yet. But I wouldn't expect you to be able to draw them any better than I am, which is not all that great. I may be okay at music, but painting is not my thing. All right. There are two other orbitals. There is the d x squared minus y squared. This one is back in the xy plane, but the electrons end up on the axes now. And then there's one more orbital that doesn't look like any of these, the dz squared orbital. In all of these other cases, the nodes themselves are lines. So they pass straight through the center there. And let me just on this first, or actually this is going to be clearer if I do it on this one, this fourth orbital. The lines I've drawn in here are the nodes. A node is where a function changes from being positive to negative. And that's what these shading patterns represent. One color is where it's plus, not in charge, but just mathematical sign. And the other color is where it's minus. It really doesn't matter which one is which, just that they are different. So we draw a node through once. If we draw it through again, that's how we get these four different regions that change color as you go from region to region to region. For the dz squared orbital, the node itself is two-dimensional. So L value of 2 doesn't really necessarily tell you the number of nodes, if we're going to be technical about it. It tells you the dimensionality of the nodes. And so you can either have two one-dimensional nodes, like the first four orbitals, or you can have one two-dimensional node, like that last orbital. That last orbital, what that two-dimensional node ends up creating, is kind of a donut shape, a torus, that is one shading pattern, and then you end up with a dumbbell shape that is the opposite color that's along the z-axis. So these are the 5D orbitals. So what? What is this related to transition metal complexes? Well, crystal field theory... Oh, sorry, yes, question. Right, and because I don't have such great drawing skills, you might not be able to see what I'm really trying to show. The first one, that rectangle, you could say, that's trying to show a plane being in the XY plane. The next one over, it's in the XZ plane, so that's why it's kind of square with us. The next one's in the YZ plane, which I was trying to tilt that way. There's better pictures of it in the text or online. But all three of those are in the planes of those axes. But the bigger point for our discussion is that those places where the electrons exist are not on the axis. I almost hate to mention this because I don't want to confuse you, but this is somewhat arbitrary. Like, how do we know that the atom is lined right up on the z-axis? Well, that's not really the question. It's that if we choose one of the orbitals to be on that axis, that it makes the other orbitals aligned with the other axes automatically. I guess what I'm really trying to say is don't worry about that aspect of it. Focus on the results that we get. So, as I was about to say, in crystal field theory, what happens is we pretend that the ion still has these d orbitals as the bonds are starting to form with these surrounding molecules called ligands. Now, it looks like we might not get to that discussion today, but one important thing to read over the weekend then is what are the different kinds of ligands? I'll just mention some terms out loud, and hopefully I'll get to where I can write some of this down later. There's a distinction between whether they are strong ligands or weak ligands as far as this. Imagine that the ligand's got lone pairs or negative charges coming at that transition metal. So how powerful is that punch, you could say, from the electrons? If you have a very strongly interacting ligand, that's going to have a large effect in what we're just about to talk about versus a weak ligand. They're usually called strong field, weak field ligands. Another aspect of ligands is how many times do they connect to that transition metal? Do they connect once, which are called monodentate? Dent, dont, that's a root word in many European languages meaning tooth. In English, it comes out as dentists. If you mispronounce the D, turn it into T. That's where the word tooth comes from. So monodentate means that it attaches once. Bidentate, twice. Tri, tetra, poly. Tri, three, tetra, four, poly, meaning multiple. If you have multiple connection points, then it's imagined that you're grasping onto that transition metal like a claw. So those are called chelates. So we'll come back to those at the end. But if I don't, make sure to focus that on that in your reading. So let's say that we have some kind of transition metal complex that ends up having octahedral symmetry. And let me see if I can find an easy example really quickly here in the text. Yes, there is a chromium complex, which has six ammonia molecules attached to it. If you have six things attached, then that geometry number of six means it's going to have octahedral geometry. So not that we have a time to do a full Vesper review today, but if you only have two things attached, that's linear. Three things attached, trigonal planar. Four, tetrahedral. Five, trigonal bipyramidal. Six, octahedral. Because what is Vesper theory really anyways? The fact that since bonds are electrons, and electrons are all charged the same, the bonds try to get as far away from each other as possible in three-dimensional space. So if you have six things attached, the geometry that gets those things as far away as possible is octahedral geometry. To better show the geometry, I am going to use what could be called stereochemical notation. What does stereochemical mean? Stereochemistry is not when you pour soda on your stereo player. It is just the fact that you can have molecules that have shapes such that you can have a pair of those molecules that are mirror images, but those mirror images don't overlap. That was something I touched on in class, and we will come back to. So when trying to show geometry, we use a wedge to indicate something that is pointed towards the reader. In other words, like it's coming out of the piece of paper at you. That versus a dash, which means it's pointed away from the reader. So if you look at that structure, what I'm trying to say is that you have four of these ligands that are in a square-like arrangement in the plane of the paper. Those are the four that are drawn with the plane line. Then there's one that's coming straight out at us, and then there's one coming straight back away from us. So notice that this is just like the X, Y, Z axes that we're using to describe these atomic orbitals. So what's the connection? Well, imagine that these atoms are approaching the transition metal. Again, pretending that we've got these orbitals that are about to have the ligands interact with them. If we're treating the ligands just as point charges, then what we're really talking about is how do those electrons from the ligands repel and interact with the electrons in the d orbitals. So if you have electrons in the d orbitals already and you have these negative charges approaching, well, that's going to be some repulsion, right? Because negative charge would repel like charge. So that means that the d orbital energies are all going to increase a little bit. But they're not all going to increase by the same amount. Why? Well, let's take the dxy orbital. That's the one that I'm trying to show has its electrons in the XY plane. But let's say that I have the ligands, which I'm going to represent by L, and they're approaching from the six cardinal directions. Well, do those six ligands directly overlap with the electrons in the d orbital? Not directly, because the electrons on those orbitals are not located on the axes. In fact, the node passes through these axes, so you have the least amount of electron density on the axes. So there's not nearly as much interaction between the ligands and the d orbitals. So since the d orbital is not on the axis, the ligands do not interact as much with them. Now I have to qualify that everything that we're discussing right now is for this octahedral geometry. The results that we're going to get here change depending on geometry. But there are only three geometries that we're going to discuss in here because those are the by far most common three. So it's not that we have a huge list of things to memorize. Let's look at another orbital, have the same discussion. Let's take that funky looking dz squared orbital. If I put the ligands in all six locations, we can see that there's fairly significant interaction along that z-axis. So the previous orbital had really no interaction. This one does. Since the d-orbital is on the axis. The ligands do interact. With it. So, if we were to look at the energy of just the d orbitals, maybe they start out at a particular energy level with it's just the ion. As I said, though, as we add the ligands, then that's going to cause the energy to go up. But once they attach and you have this geometry, they split. And two of the orbitals are the ones on axis, so they are higher in energy. Those are the dx squared minus y squared and the dz squared orbital, because they are the two on axis. The other three orbitals, allow me to pull this down for a moment, the three that look the same, the first three here, those are off axis, so they don't interact as much, which is why we have three orbitals that are lower. This is what is known as octahedral splitting. And there's an energy gap associated with that, which is often labeled delta, maybe in this case delta O, meaning the splitting due to octahedral geometry. So one more time, quickly through this. You have to know the 5D orbitals, because this explanation does work reasonably well to predict the types of transitions that are going to occur. We'll talk about what that transition is in just a moment. Once you know what the d orbitals are, you do have to know a little bit about geometry. Right now, we've been talking exclusively about octahedral geometry, but there are two others. There's tetrahedral, which is just like methane, CH4, and then there is square planar, which is a geometry that particularly the platinum group, platinum and palladium complexes, often tend to be square planar. We're going to focus on the octahedral because it's the easiest, and it's the most one. It's the one that's most commonly in textbooks, the more full discussion. Yes? The red, right here, you mean? The gap that's created between the d orbitals. So the d orbitals used to be equal in energy to each other, and now they've been forced to separate. What does that cause? Well, let's say that we had this cobalt complex. This is another thing we've got to practice on. But you could see that up here, did I say cobalt? Chromium, sorry. This chromium complex is plus 3 charge. Now, chromium is an exception just like copper is. So chromium is normally 4s1 3d5. If it is plus 3 in charge, then what's going to be its configuration? Again, if chromium is argon, 4s1 3d5. Let me just comment that it is 4s1 3d5 because of it's due to subshell stabilization. The same thing I talked about in lab when we were talking about the octet rule, the fact that the octet rule is nothing more than the S and the P subshells being filled. Well, half-filled subshells end up being favorable as well. And so for similar reasons, an S electron is popped up into the 3D subshell because doing so gets more energy back than the cost of moving the electron. Same story as for copper. Yes?
Does that say CU
overigens? That was me being in a hurry and not putting another parenthesis. Okay, so let's say that we already know that this is the configuration for chromium. Then what's chromium plus 3 going to be? Because which electron comes off first? 4s or 3d? 4s. So one of the 4s's, the 4s, comes off. Two of the 3d's come off. So we end up with 3D3. What does that mean? That for this particular complex, we're going to end up with 3 electrons, one each, in each of the lower orbitals. Why do they end up in separate orbitals? Which of the 3 filling rules governs that? This is where you say, oh crap, he's really going to make us know this. Yeah. Hund's rule, that's right. Hund's rule says that you put one electron in each equal energy orbital before you go back and pair them up because pairing costs energy. Okay, great. So what about this transition I keep referring to? If you have this splitting in d orbitals, that causes a gap in energy. So I'm putting that this gap is a form of energy. There's an equation which relates the particle nature of light and the wave nature of light. I'll try to give you the short version of this explanation. On the left here, this is the energy of a photon. A photon is us imagining that light acts like a particle. On the right-hand side, this nu, it looks like a V, but it's not, is the frequency of light, treating it like a wave. In quantum mechanics, the big conceptual heartache that you get is from trying to resolve the fact that you have electrons that are acting like waves and particles and waves and particles and waves and particles. Light's the same thing. This equation bridges the two worlds. It says that if you have light of a particular frequency, that also means you have photons, each one of which has a particular energy. The constant that relates these two is Planck's constant, which shows up all over the place. For example, what is the normal allowed value for the quantum number for spin for an electron? Plus or minus 1/2, right? No. It's actually plus or minus 1/2 h divided by 2 pi. Also, for your physicists out there, 1/2 h bar. So that same h is still, again, Planck's constant. Planck's constant shows up in other places. Planck's constant, to kind of state it poetically, determines the granularity of energy in the universe. In other words, if energy comes in packets, h tells you the size. So that h constant relates the frequency of light to the energy of a photon. So if you have light that is the right energy so that you get a photon that is the same energy of this gap, then that means that an electron can be bumped up in energy. That's because these lower energy electrons are effectively the valence electrons. In molecular orbital theory, the equivalent expression would be highest occupied molecular orbital, the orbital with the highest energy electrons, the ones most likely to do something. Where are the electrons going to go? Well, if they were going to expend the least amount of energy possible, those electrons would want to go to just the next highest energy level. There may be higher energy levels they could go to, but just the next highest one is where they would tend to go to. These transitions for many transition complexes happen to have energy gaps that correspond to frequencies of light that are in the visible light range. That's why so many transition metal complexes have distinctive colors to them. So in a transition metal complex, in which the energies of the d orbitals are split, if light of the correct frequency that corresponds to a photon with just the right energy to jump this gap, you could say, or that matches this gap, an electron can be excited from a lower energy orbital to a higher one. Once you've added that energy in, it's added, it's done, it's gone. What is keeping that electron hovering in midair? Nothing. So eventually that electron's going to fall back down again, release that same amount of energy. So after absorbing that energy, the electron will release it again. Causing light to be released. With the same frequency as was absorbed. Or at least potentially. Because to have a more thorough discussion, we can talk about how, well, what if that light doesn't initially get released? What if the electrons are constantly bombarded somehow? Like you were shining white light on them. And so they're constantly absorbing a particular frequency of light. Well, if it's absorbing some frequencies and not others, then whatever color it absorbs is not the one that you see. And that is what this discussion of the color wheel is in your text. So we don't have time to tackle that one. That's a little more complicated subject than for the last 5 minutes of class. But do look at the color wheel. But what I described up so far tells you about the types of, or tells you about why the energies split and then what's the significance. The fact that these cause, that these transition cause the colors of these transition metal complexes. Now, since we've gotten this far, there's one more thought, which is what happens if you do have one of these strongly interacting ligands versus a weak ligand. In other words, if you have what's called strong field ligands versus weak field ligands. There is a table in your text, or a diagram in your text, that shows the range of ligands. This complex I originally did with ammonia, but let's say that we switch that to carbon monoxide, CO. That is a very strong field ligand. Let's say that we had used the weak field ligand, one example of which is water. And in fact, I'm going to change which metal ion that we're dealing with. And let's say that we had let's use that same chromium ion. Let's say that we had chromium, in fact, in its plus 2 state instead. What's the point that I'm making here? If we have one of these strong field ligands, it's going to cause a large gap between the d orbitals. As you might expect, the electrons are going to follow the normal filling rules. Chromium plus 2 is a d4 ion. Why? Because remember that we saw earlier that chromium is 4s1, 3d5. If we take off two electrons, that means you lose the S electron, you lose one of the D electrons, you're left with four of them. So you put the first four electrons in, and you end up with one of them having to be paired up. Well, what if you have a weak field ligand? Which means there's not as much splitting. So what? What if the splitting is small enough where after we add those first three electrons, the last one we add in, it would cost more energy to pair it up than to put it in a higher energy level? Well, then it will go into that higher energy level instead, violating, it looks like, the violating Hund's rule and the Aufbau principle. But these exceptions occur any time that you end up with lower energy because of it. So when the splitting energy is larger than pairing energy, the normal filling rules are followed. But if the splitting energy is smaller than the pairing energy, electrons can occupy higher energy orbitals. Which means that the normal filling rules will not be followed. Where we'll finish this discussion up with is the fact that on the left, because we end up with paired spins, if we were to look at the magnetic properties of this complex, these two spins magnetically would cancel each other. You only have these two unpaired spins, so this is called a low spin complex. But if we have small splitting, which means the electrons don't necessarily pair up, we have more unpaired electrons, and so this is called a high spin complex. We are out of time, but this is what we're going to pick up right with on Monday. The transition metal complex is splitting, and then with stereochemistry and ligands.